Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome once again to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host for the next 45 minutes. Today we have a very interesting show. The TV stations these days seem to be filled to the brim with CSI-type cop shows, intrepid investigators solving seemingly unsolvable cases, sometimes years or even decades after the event. Well, sometimes fact is indeed stranger than fiction. Today's story actually starts in June of 1981, almost 28 years ago. Two people were found shot to death in the living room of an apartment at the rear of the PM pub in Lakemore, Illinois. The victims were the tavern's owner, 37-year-old Ronald Scharf, and his barmaid. I do believe it was her very first day on the job, Patricia Freeman. This was the first homicide ever in this small community of some 800 people, and I believe it's about 45 miles northeast of Chicago. To explore this strange tale and hopefully resolve this case, I have some guests. Paul Scharf, who is Ronald's son, Holly Hager, a one-time babysitter for Paul, and cut out of the same mold as Nancy Drew. We also have Dennis Griffin, co-author of the book Collada. Hello, everyone.
Hello, Mr. Barrett. Hello. Thanks for having us.
Joining me on the journalism side is my good buddy Mondo from Death by 1,000 Paper Cuts. That's dbkp.com. And if you have time, it's a site well worth visiting. Randy's an investigative journalist and always fun to talk to. Hi, Randy. Oh, good to
Hi.
Chat with you again.
Great, yeah. That's a pretty good intro.
Okay, let's start with Paul. Paul, how about explaining to us what happened in 1981?
Sure. My father was friends with a man named Larry Newman, who was a member of the Hole in the Wall gang back in Chicago. The Hole in the Wall gang is a part of the Chicago Outfit. They were in charge of the Las Vegas scam operation. If you're familiar with the movie Casino, that movie is based on the Tony Spilotro era, Las Vegas, and Frank Collada was a lieutenant for Tony Spilotro, and Larry Newman worked for Frank Collada in the Hole in the Wall gang. And prior to that, my father was friends or acquaintance with Larry Newman. They used to play cards at my father's tavern in Lakemore, Illinois. And what we know is a few weeks before June 2nd of 1981, and Larry Newman was already out in the Las Vegas area. He was formerly a McHenry resident, and that's the township that Lakemore's found in. And my father was at the bar one evening where he had Larry Newman's ex-wife was there. And she was drinking, and she was getting a little inebriated. And my father had a thing about women drinking at the bar. They started acting uninhibited. He would ask them to correct themselves, and if they couldn't do that, he would exit them out of the bar. From what I understand, Larry Newman's ex-wife was actually hitting on my father, and so he asked her to leave. And there was words spat back and forth. She was obviously very upset about that. What wound up happening after that is she called Larry Newman in Las Vegas, and Frank Colada was there at the time when he received that phone call. And what she told Larry was that my father grabbed her by the neck and threw her out the bar, which isn't true. Holly's father, a good friend of my dad's, was there and witnessed that. And that enraged Larry Newman, and he vowed to go back to Chicago to kill my father because he saw this as a great disrespect to him. And Frank Colada tried talking him out of it, and he actually thought that he had talked him out of it, but Frank was wrong. Larry Newman flew out to Chicago with another outfit man, Tommy Amata. Tommy Amata wasn't aware of what Larry's intentions were. He was there to assist on another caper in Chicago, but as soon as they got to Chicago O'Hare Airport, they drove straight to Lakemoor, and that's when Larry Newman killed my father and Patricia Freeman.
Okay. Now, the case wasn't solved at the time. It's taken 26, 27, almost 28 years. What did the police do? Did they drop the ball?
Well, they certainly interviewed some people, and they had some suspects. One of the suspects was a former boyfriend or boyfriend of Patricia Freeman, and they seemed really resonating with him or focusing in on him. However, they had an interview with Jim Hager, Holly's father, and Jim told them that if you want to solve this crime, one of the people that you really should be looking at is Larry Newman. And what the police should have known at that time is Larry Newman already done a stint in Joliet for a triple murder, a murder of a tavern owner, a barmaid, and a newspaper vendor who was right outside that tavern. Apparently that bar owner or somebody there shorted Larry $2, and he went back there and certainly got even for that. And he was put to prison, I think, for 125 years or something to that effect, but he was paroled, I believe, in 11 or 16 years. But that's how he met Frank Colada, doing that stint in Joliet.
Let's bring Holly on, Holly Hager. As I understand it, you're the super sleuth, the Nancy Drew that pulled all of this information together. What made you get involved with this case?
Well, you know, this it was all quite accidental. It's always been a question to people around here. You know, I live in the same area still, about, you know, who did those murders, because it was a big deal. You know, this is not a very crime-ridden area, very small town. And it, you know, there was always just rumors, you know, yeah, it looked like a mob hit. They said, you know, it must have been the mob. But there was really no reason, and it was never solved. And my dad was up here in Illinois. He lives in Arkansas now. He was up here visiting, and June, and me and my son were driving him home to Arkansas, and the subject came up. Hey, Dad, I asked him, you know, who do you think, you know, killed Ron and Pat? And, you know, he proceeded to, you know, tell me what he thought. I don't ever remember asking him before, but it was just something that was, you know, that was never solved. And he had said that he thought it was still unsolved, and that, because I wasn't sure if the case had been solved and closed, and, you know, I just didn't know about it because I was, you know, a teenager at the time. But I can read you. I wrote this. I just found this on the I had copied this email that I sent to Dennis Griffin right after finishing the book because I was so moved to do so. And I can run through it real quick for you. Just,
certainly.
What exactly? Because this is what I typed to him upon finishing the book, because I was so stunned at the you know, what I had discovered. It says, a few weeks ago, I was driving my father home after a visit. It was a 12-hour drive. At 64, my dad has a great memory and is full of stories. Well, we got on the subject of the murders of Ron Scharf and Pat Freeman. Ron had been a very close friend of my dad's. We both wondered why their murders were never solved. My dad had been suspected and questioned by the McHenry prosecutor. My dad said he thought Pat's boyfriend probably did it because he hadn't wanted her to work at the bar, and someone had said they'd seen his van parked across the street on the night of the murders. He also said that Ron had some gambling debts, but that he, my dad, didn't feel they were large enough for him to be killed over by the mob. That brought up the name Larry Newman. My dad knew him pretty good. He told us a story of how he had talked him out of killing some lady once who didn't return my dad's work keys. He told Larry he didn't want to get fired from his job over it. He said Larry and Ron were also on good terms, so he said Larry wouldn't have murdered Ron. He did say that Ron had problems with Larry's wife picking up on him and how he, Ron, called her a whore and had stated, "You think I'm nuts? I know your husband." Anyway, when I returned home, I decided to search and see if, in fact, those murders had just went unsolved. I couldn't find anything in any newspaper archives with even an article. I thought that was strange. McHenry is a pretty small town, and that was a huge story when it happened. I was a teenager at the time. I then remembered the name Larry Newman. I searched Illinois prison inmates and found nothing. I Googled his name and found a few things. I found an article stating that he died last year in an Illinois prison. I also found that Collada's name came up with his often. After reading an excerpt from the book, I decided to buy Collada's. Well, there was the answer in black and white. Although the names weren't printed in the book, I know who the people were that were murdered in the back room of PM Pub in Lakemoor. I don't even think Ron's widow or three boys know. I used to babysit for them. Do you have any idea why Larry Newman was never charged and prosecuted? I know he was serving a life sentence, but it was all just left open. It is strange how I came to get the answer of who did it. My dad was surprised, too. I am sending him the book today. I wish Larry was still alive so I could have attempted contact. Thanks for writing that book.
Wow.
That was the letter.
Yep, and that's an excellent segue. I mean, you're a natural radio guest, Dennis. Tell us about, you know, your thoughts. You know, when did you first learn that this book was at the heart of solving a huge mystery, and what were your first impressions?
Well, you just heard it from Holly. That's the first I heard.
Right.
When I was working with Mr. Collada on the book, I assumed that the case had been solved. I had no idea it was that the two homicides were still open cases. So I was, stunned as Holly was to learn that Frank in his book described an unsolved or two unsolved murders and named the killer. So I was quite shocked by it, and then I was pleased in the sense that if this could lead to some closure, because, I mean, these families, these Scharfs and Freemans, have been 27 years of uncertainty of what happened to Patricia and Ron. And so I felt it was a good thing if this would lead possibly to a resolution of the cases and some closure for the families.
Okay, let's unleash the dogs of war. Randy, have a couple of questions.
I do. I have a couple questions. Okay, Holly. Okay, they suspected your dad, I read, because of a car that he had sold somebody. Here's a question, because you live there, and maybe Paul, right?
Yeah.
Okay. You guys live there. Is the police department like just a little tiny, maybe a couple guys, and that's it? Because that Larry Newman, I mean, he's already had a triple homicide over two bucks in a bar, so I don't understand why they wouldn't have taken a hard look at him. Was it because he was not around the area?
No, I mean, that certainly wasn't the case. Larry Newman was in custody at the time of 1982 because of the Bertha's break-in, where the feds caught Frank and the whole in the wall gang and that subsequently turned Frank into becoming a government witness. So, and they first heard it from Jim in 1981, Larry Newman, and then the FBI contacted the McHenry County Sheriff in 1982 based on the information of from Frank and two individuals from McHenry County, potentially a police type and a DA type, flew out to San Diego, talked to Frank, and Frank basically told them what was happening in Las Vegas at the same time that Jim witnessed the altercation between Larry Newman's ex-wife and my father.
But, I mean, why didn't they just naturally latch on to Larry Newman? I mean, he's probably the only guy in town that has three homicides on his record.
We're wondering the same thing, Randy. We're not sure. I mean, that's what everybody would be inclined to think, that that would be the guy you'd really start looking at.
Yeah. Yeah, I wondered about that. I wondered why they, have they ever charged him? Well, I guess it wouldn't do any good. He's dead. That was just something I couldn't understand. I mean, when I found out that he had three homicides before that, and I couldn't believe they lay him out after 11 years. You know, I thought that was pretty lenient, and then he went out and kills two other people. For Dennis, I got a question. When you were talking to Collada to write the book,
mm-hmm.
He was in the Witness Protection Program, right?
No, he went in, but he was out when I talked with him.
Oh, he was in and they got out?
Yeah, he's out now. He's no longer in witness protection. He does have a new identity and so forth, but he...
Oh, okay. Well, did that make it tough? Did you have to, like, be careful if you were out somewhere? You couldn't call him Mr. Collada or something? You had to call him Mr. Smith or whatever his new name is?
It was... that's almost a whole story in itself. It was difficult. Even though Frank is not still a member of the witness protection family... he's still quite security conscious, and there are all kinds of steps we had to go through. For example, I was not allowed initially to know how to get a hold of him. We had to go through the former FBI agent. So if I had a question for Frank, I would have to call the FBI guy, who would in turn have to get a hold of Frank, and then Frank would have to call me. And it was a very bizarre setup. And eventually we bonded well enough that I was able to learn how to reach him and so forth. But
okay. Well, I was going to say, now, did you ever meet him?
Oh, yes.
Okay, well, wasn't he scared maybe somebody would follow you?
Precautions are taken. I don't really want to go any further.
Yeah.
He's very cognizant of security.
I guess when you rat people out, you have to be.
How old is Collada?
He turned 70 last month.
Oh. So, I mean, he's not a young pup, but he's hardly old then.
Yeah, it's a babe in the woods, I told him. I might add that, if anybody followed the family secrets trial in Chicago last year, where Clown Lombardo and several of them were convicted for some old gangland hits, including the Spilotro brothers. Well, based on those convictions, almost everybody that Frank would have posed a threat to Frank as far as the old mob days is either dead or in prison. Frank's concern now about security isn't so much from that side of the street. He is more concerned about some young up-and-comer. You know, like the old Western movies where the young gunslinger always wanted to knock off the old gunslinger to get a reputation. He is more concerned about that type of situation than he is about a former associate.
That'd be a tough way to live.
I would.
Oh, I would say that's a very tough way to live. Holly.
Yeah.
You're clearly a very tenacious lady. Is this the start of a new career? Do you have another case?
No, I don't. It's just, this was just something that, if you have something in your life that there's a big question, and, there weren't computers back then, everybody, I just had the access to be able to Google names, and it was just by luck I was able to, you know, come up with it. And I'm glad it gives answers to people now, because it's just strange when stuff is left open-ended and there's never a real answer of, you know, who did this big thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not going to pursue a detective career, but you know, it was just I happened to be the person that that read that book and seen it in there and knew who it was, so it was just a lucky thing.
I think it's amazing. That's what I think. I'm not lucky, amazing.
It was really shocking. It was really surprising and really shocking. And I'm telling you, after I seen it, and I know I know who did it now, there's no question. I mean, the police really need to close the case and determine who the culprit was.
Interestingly enough, before we went on air, we were all kind of just chatting, and Paul, you made the comment that the police are imminently planning on arresting someone. Now, Newman's dead. Who could they possibly be planning on arresting?
Well, I really don't know, because I'm not privy to the investigation. but we could make some assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, possibly his ex-wife. You know, I mean, basically, she hired a hitman. Maybe there wasn't no money transferred, but, you know, she manipulated his emotions, his feelings, and maybe that was the currency that she used. And there's also, Tommy Amata, who was there. He wasn't involved with it, or he wasn't aware of what was going to transpire, but he was there. But honestly, I don't know.
Tommy Amata, let's talk about him for a second. He is still alive and well and outside of the jail system?
As far as I know, yes.
Randy.
Yeah.
I'm sure you have more questions. Have a
yeah,
go.
I have a question for Paul. What do you think, I guess you didn't know at the time, but now looking back, what do you think about, here's this Larry Newman. He guns down two people. He guns down three people before that, and he's in prison for 11 years. Now, he goes out to Las Vegas, and he robs a place. I guess he killed a jeweler in the process, and they give him life. So, I mean, I don't understand. I mean, what's your thoughts on the criminal justice system?
That's a good question, Randy. I am pursuing justice, and I don't believe that this should be a force emanating from myself. I believe internally the McHenry County Sheriff's Department should be taking their own initiatives. They shouldn't be requiring Nancy Drew babysitters. They shouldn't be requiring victim members, forcing this onto them. So I'm very disappointed. I'm from Chicago. I'm from Illinois. I think it's no secret that our political and justice system's very corrupt, you know, recently with Blagojevich and everything else. It's kind of a common thing, and, you know, it's really unfortunate in Chicago and Illinois.
Yeah, I wondered about that. The other thing I wondered, do you think that the police department or the sheriff's department, I guess there's a sheriff's department there, right? That's who's in
Correct.
Charge of it? Okay.
Correct.
Because I live in a small town, we don't even have a police department. We have sheriffs for the county. And do you think that they, after they got to the point that, do you think they were just overmatched, that they didn't have the resources to do it, or they didn't want to do it, or they looked at it and said, we'll let somebody else take care of it, somebody with more resources like the FBI, or I don't know. It sounds to me like the DA and the one sheriff, they got a free trip to San Diego. They probably got a little sun. It's a little sunnier there than it is in Illinois for a couple mm-hmm. days, and but they didn't act on any information they got, it sounded like.
Correct. I believe you're right. Originally, my family had thought, you know, they were outmatched originally. But now going back and reviewing what it is that we know or what we understand, this case was pushed right up into their lap. I mean, you almost had to create activities not to solve the case. So we're absolutely puzzled and angered by why this wasn't pursued further. It certainly was. I mean, we've got babysitters, we got victims, we've got civilians that would have worked this case a lot better than what apparently it had.
Has it crossed your mind? This is a salacious thing to say, that maybe the police didn't have any interest in resolving it?
I would have to say that is a quite a strong possibility. I mean, we really do have to consider that looking back based on what it is that we understand. As far as what it is that we can tell, we don't know if Larry Newman was even questioned, which is unfathomable for us, you know, again, as Holly said, her father was considered a suspect at one point of the time. Well, he was a good friend of the family's, and if he can get on the list, how is it that a triple murderer from McHenry does not? I don't know.
Well, this goes back to the fact that he did have connections with the Chicago mob, and they did have fairly long-reaching tentacles. Yeah, just maybe someone greased some palms and said, hey, let this one slide.
I think we certainly have to consider the possibilities of that, especially considering the circumstances. Now, at the time that Frank Collada decided to turn government witness, he was very high up in the food chain of the Chicago outfit. He had the understanding of the hierarchy of the outfit. He had the understanding of the crimes that are committed by the outfit and who had done them. So he was an absolute threat to the Chicago outfit, in particular to Tony Spilotro, where the Chicago outfit had a heavily investment in the Las Vegas skim operation. So there's a potential that things might have happened to protect Tony Spilotro, the Las Vegas scam, and the Chicago outfit.
I have a question for Dennis.
Yes.
This is a technical question.
Uh-oh.
Okay. How do you get acquainted with Mr. Collada to write a book about him? How does that happen? And what do? You contact him, say, hey, I hear you're in hiding.
Right. You can't Google him.
Yeah.
It was a rather, again, this whole thing was bizarre. I'll make it very brief. I wrote an earlier book before Collada. I wrote a book a year before in 2006 called The Battle for Las Vegas, The Law versus the Mob. And that book was about the Tony Spilotro era in Vegas that was dramatized in Casino. And I desperately wanted to talk to a mobster. I had all kinds of law enforcement people, former FBI, former Metro Police Department, intelligence detectives, and so on. And I couldn't, the mobsters who've been part of that gang, so-called hole-in-the-wall gang, were either dead or whereabouts unknown, which I felt left me lacking. I did want to get the other side of the story. It happened that Dennis Arnoldy, the FBI guy, was one of my former law enforcement sources for Battle for Las Vegas. And after the book was at the printers, he called me one day and he said, would you have any interest in talking to Frank Collada? I said, it most certainly would. He says, well, as his handler, he says, which happens, and handler, I'm not sure that's the word I should be using, but as his debriefer, he said, we've kept in touch over the years. He said, I can get a hold of him. If you want, I'll see if he'll talk with you. So we ended up, I got about a 3-minute phone interview with Frank, and I made a little addition to the book, to Battle. I submitted it to the publisher, and they added it to the book before it went to the printer. And I thought that was the end of it. And then about 3 or 4 months later, I was thinking, I said, that Collada would have one heck of a story to tell. I said, I wonder if he's ever thought about it. So I contacted Dennis Arnoldy again, and I said, hey, if you're ever talking to Frank, would you just see if he's ever thought about doing anything about, whether it be articles for a magazine or a book or whatever, about his criminal career. And it just so happened that Frank had been thinking about it, and he had over 400 pages of transcripts made up of his life story. So we met after a whole lot of security precautions in a hotel room in Vegas, and we talked for about 4 hours and made the deal that we would co-author the book.
Now, one last question about this. As a former mobster and a guy that's involved in a lot of unpleasant things, were you ever worried about whether he would be satisfied with the job you did writing the book?
Yes.
I mean, he would be a harsh critic to have.
Yes, he would. And I'll tell you, that was one of the things that was frustrating to begin with about not having the amount of contact with him that was necessary. And we eventually, as he became to trust me more, started not only the phone calls right on a regular basis and direct without having to go through Dennis Arnoldy, we started meeting in person fairly often. And that certainly helped things. But he read, or I read to him, or what have you, every single word in that book. And we went over it numerous times. If I had a question that I didn't quite understand, of course, I would ask him. And then he'd read it. If he didn't understand or thought I was in error the way I'd written it, we'd discuss it. And if it had to be rewritten or edited, it would be. So I wanted to make sure. Well, first of all, my reputation is on the line. Not only I don't want Frank mad at me, but I don't want to lose credibility with readers. So I wanted to make sure this book was as accurate as possible. And so for several reasons, we spent an awful lot of time going over that book, virtually line by line, going over that manuscript. And we had some areas where, for liability purposes, things had to be worded in a certain way or maybe certain things not included. And, you know, we discussed those and we made some changes and had some debates, but we ended up that we were both satisfied with the final product.
I'm sure that many people are going to want to read this book as a direct result of this little radio show. Where can people find copies of it? What's its title, etc.?
The title is Collada, Collotta. Subtitle, The Life of a Chicago Criminal, Las Vegas Mobster, and Government Witness. And let me just mention, if any of your listeners have ever seen the Casino movie, Frank was the technical consultant to the movie from the mob side. Scorsese and Pileggi reached out to him through the Department of Justice, and he is in all the murder scenes as the hitman.
Really?
And there's one scene in the movie where near the end, after all these godfathers have been indicted for skimming, and they all show up in court with oxygen masks and nurses and so forth, they meet in the back of the courtroom in a recess, and they decide what potential witnesses against them need to be dealt with. And after that, a series of murders takes place. And on the screen, the caption says, Costa Rica. And you hear some pop-pop of gunshots, and this guy comes running out of the house, and two hitmen follow him outside as he collapses to the sidewalk. And one guy comes up and says, where are you going, jag off? And he shoots him in the head. Well, that is Frank Collada. And that scene is actually based on the murder that Frank did in real life in Las Vegas in 1979. So Nick Pileggi was quite enthused that he had a real-life hitman come out of retirement and recreate the killing on the screen. So, yeah, the book is available any of the online outlets, Amazon and so forth, through the publisher directly at Huntington Press, H-U-N-T-I-N-G-T-O-N, press.com. And it's in stock in some bookstores, others it can be ordered through the bookstore.
Great. Paul, let's go back to you. You must be a pretty bitter guy. You know, they dropped the ball so many years ago. I mean, you may have a small amount of closure, comfort that eventually, you know, there is a solution. I mean, how can this be prevented from happening in the future?
You know, that's a good question that I think it's got to be solved at the community level. How is it that you deal with this? You know, back in 1982, when Frank turned, it was in the Chicago Tribune. And, you know, if you take the newspaper articles that are printed today and remove Holly and I from it, these articles, you can't tell what year that they came from. So my mom heard or read herself one of these articles explaining Frank Collada's, you know, with Larry Newman and the killings that took place at McHenry County, and then the one other killing, which was alluded to earlier about the jeweler, the Brown case, I believe it was. And so my mom called our the chief investigator, who was Detective George Hendel at the time, who later became the sheriff of McHenry County, and point blank asked him, you know, have you guys solved my husband's murder? And he said, what's in the paper is not true. Now, I'm not sure what's in that paper that isn't true. Everything that I've read certainly has been true. Everything has been reaffirmed by Frank Collada as being true. So I'm not sure. When you go up against something like that point blank, and you reach out to them, because they certainly wasn't reaching out to my mother, telling her what was going on, I don't know what it is that you do. But if you get something that tells you something's not right, there's a good chance it's not.
Yeah. What, just out of idle curiosity, I mean, you were something like 9 years old when this happened?
On June 2nd, the day of the murder, I was 10. My birthday was June 5th, the day of my father's wake.
What happened to the bar? Did your mother get out of the business? Or?
Well, she wanted to, I'm sure. But unfortunately, that's not how life works. She
okay.
had three boys in a house that she wanted to keep for all of us. We were on food stamps from that point after losing my father, and she went back and she reopened that bar. And she went back and she worked it with the help of Holly's father, Jim, as well, because we also owned another tavern in Brookfield, Illinois.
Well, that must have been a pretty traumatic period in your life.
It absolutely was. I mean, you know, I lost my father, but I kind of lost my mother, too, in the interim of that because, you know, she wasn't available to be our mom. She had to get out in the front and be the breadwinner to make sure that our lives weren't uprooted. That would have been an awful time for anything else to happen. So she worked very hard in keeping the family together, and you know. But the result of that is, you know, we missed our mom for a couple of years in a time that we probably needed her the most.
I actually grew up in a bar. My parents owned one in England. And
gotcha.
I understand exactly. I mean, I felt very isolated, but. you know, when you actually look at the economics, they had no money to pay someone else to do it. They had to work.
Absolutely, absolutely. It sounds very similar what it is that you're telling me. The small bar ownership isn't the fast track to wealth building. And if you can maintain a life from it, you're very successful in itself. But when you're doing it in a mad scramble, when you're fighting basically for your life and for your children, it really becomes something else. And it's really unfortunate. That's what my mom had to do, but that's what she had to do. We all had to do things that wasn't right.
In fact, my theory, and you know, occasionally I'll tell my little story, and someone will say, "Oh, wow, that's what I'm going to do when I retire. I'm going to open a bar." And I look at them aghast and say, "Why would you do that? You'll be working harder than you have ever worked in your entire life."
Absolutely.
It is no easy way to make money.
People,
right.
I would highly recommend trying to get that job as a Walmart greeter, or maybe cutting keys in the back of an Ace Hardware or something, but owning the bar, that wouldn't be it.
Randy, you have a couple more.
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, people always say whenever you have a small business, they say, boy, it must be great where you don't have any bosses, where you're your own boss. But you know why? It's like when you have a bar or any small business. Everybody walks through the door is your boss.
Yep.
You know, I mean, I did have a question, either for Paul or for Holly. The ex-wife, the one that started the whole deal, right? Does she still get drunk? Does she still come to the bar? What's going on with her?
Holly, I really don't know too much about her. I know that she occasionally came to my father's bar based on what Jim had said, but I don't really know any more than that. Do you, Holly?
I don't. I don't even know her last name. I don't know where she is or what she does or.
Well, I couldn't believe this guy would murder two people over an ex. Most people. I don't know. They would do anything but do something for their ex.
Yeah, it makes you wonder what she said to him on the phone exactly, you know, when she called him out of Nevada to come back to
She must have known it wouldn't take too much to set him off. I mean, he killed three people over $2, so.
Yeah, he seemed very short fused, almost looking for a reason. I think he probably got a thrill out of it. You know, he probably didn't need much.
Yeah.
To get him going.
Well, I think that's a good point that Holly makes right there, that he got a thrill out of it. You're talking about a man that didn't have to kill for a living. He did it because he wanted to. He had a huge trust fund that he received on the passing of his father. His father was a successful salesman, from what I understand. So Larry did all this killing and burglarizing and all this because he loved it.
Jeez.
Simon?
Well, I mean, everyone needs a hobby.
Yeah. I think Dennis is trying to talk to you, Simon.
I'm sorry?
I think Dennis is trying to talk to you.
Dennis.
Simon, before we run out of time, could I make just 2 points?
Sure.
First of all, when we were talking, when Holly was talking about her Nancy Drew work, I think she was being a little modest, because I spent most of my adult life as an investigator, and luck sometimes plays a part in it, but it takes the tenacity to create your own luck to some degree. And she did the Google searches and made the calls and talked to her dad and so on and so forth to get the results that she got. So, yes, sometimes there may be some luck involved, but without the putting forth the effort to reach that luck, to get lucky, you're not going to make it. So she was willing and is still, I believe, putting in the effort.
I'm just very stubborn, And I will search for answers until I find what I need to know, you know. Just you don't stop it. You know, there's always more information you can gather if you.
Absolutely, always another door to be opened or another person to contact. And the second point, when I was talking to Mr. Arnoldy, Dennis Arnoldy, last night and this morning, he although he couldn't because of a previous commitment join us today, he said it's very important to make clear to listeners or people who have read the newspaper articles and so forth what the situation was with Frank at the time he gave this information to the authorities in 1982. Frank had enrolled. He was a government witness. He was a contract had been issued on his life by Tony Spilotro and the Chicago outfit. So he was facing a death sentence from them, and he was going to be convicted. He had they had a very strong case against him, a Nevada state case for burglary-related charges. And as a predicate felon, he was facing life in prison if convicted. So when Frank made his deal, he was basically a matter of life and death in his case. And one of the agreements he reached with the government was this. He had to volunteer to tell everything he knew about all his criminal associates. And he had to be totally honest because everything he told them was going to be checked. And if he was caught in a lie, his deal for witness protection was void. And basically that meant he was either going to die as a result of the mob or he was going to spend the rest of his life behind bars. So some people wonder, well, can we believe this guy? You know, what was his motive for blowing Newman in, telling the story in 1982? That was the impetus behind it. He was fighting for his life. He had nothing to gain, but everything to lose if he either withheld that story, made the story up, or what have you. So there was no motivation for Frank to make it up entirely or to lie about it.
I have to unfortunately cut this show short. Our 45 minutes, alas, has gone all too quickly. I really, really want to thank our guests, Paul Scharf. Paul, thank you so much for letting me know about this important story. Holly Hager, I still think you could easily get a job in the investigative world. And
thank you. I'm flattered. You give me more credit than I'm sure I'm due, but okay.
And Dennis,
you're the only one that thinks that, though, Holly.
And Dennis, a pleasure talking to you. And I do hope that at some point I will get an opportunity to review Coletta, your book.
I hope you do, too.
Okay. Randy, as always, it's always fun talking to you. You have the best questions.
Oh, my pleasure, and I'll tell you, Jen would have been here, but she had another engagement. She's a walking crime encyclopedia.
Okay. Folks, thank you so much, and I really do hope that this particular case is finally put to rest. And I also hope that some severe heat is put on the police department. This is Simon Barrett saying thank you very much for listening, and we'll talk to you again soon. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.